From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Middle East Peace Conference has brought changes within the Palestinian leadership. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss those changes with Edward Said. He's a former member of the Palestine National Council and a professor of English at Columbia University. The Israeli police have called for the arrest and prosecution of Hanan Ashrawi, a prominent advisor to the Palestinian delegation. We'll talk with Deputy Consul General of Israel in New York, Mark Sofer. Later, we look at how America's restaurants have changed through the years with John Mariani, author of America Eats Out. Michael Jackson's new video premiered on TV last night. TV critic David Bianculli has the review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Martin Scorsese's new film, Cape Fear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has approved the unemployment benefits bill by a vote of 91-2. The agreement came after Senate leaders from both parties announced that they'd resolved the problem that stalled the measure extending unemployment benefits. The measure was held up by senators who claimed that their states received too little additional aid. The bill now provides either 13 or 20 weeks of additional jobless benefits for people who've used up their regular 6 months' worth of payments, depending on a state's unemployment rate. Approval of the bill could mean that some checks might reach those whose benefits have expired in time for Thanksgiving. The stock market took a nosedive today, posting the biggest one-day loss in more than 2 years. NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
Blue-chip stocks with the highest investment ratings led the decline, spurred on by computerized selling. When the market closed, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had dropped 120 points to post nearly a 4% loss. The market hadn't sustained such a drop since October 1989. Trading was active today at 236 million shares on the New York Stock Exchange. The average share of common stock lost $1.19. Analysts said the sell-off reflected growing concern about economic recovery. The Federal Reserve reported today that industrial production remained flat in October, as it had been for several months. Experts have been counting on the industrial sector to power the recovery. I'm Elaine Corey reporting.
There's yet another government crackdown on pro-democracy advocates in the East African nation of Kenya today. Secret police have been rounding up government critics and are still hunting for others who have been called for a rally tomorrow to protest widespread government corruption and one-party political rule. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's secret police were knocking on doors, arresting pro-democracy activists throughout the early hours this morning. A member of one activist's family told me that police searched their house at 2 a.m. in vain, peering into cupboards, looking under the beds, hoping to find the widely respected politician and put him in jail. Another activist, who served as Kenya's first vice president and is more than 80 years old, wasn't so lucky. He's already locked up. The activists said they called the rally tomorrow to press for peaceful, democratic change in Kenya. But President Daniel Arap Moi has denounced them as anarchists who seek to cause chaos and bloodshed. An American embassy spokesman said U.S. officials are outraged by the arrests. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Nairobi.
Stock prices plunged today on Wall Street in a late sell-off that pushed the market into its biggest drop in more than 2 years. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 120 points to finish the day at 2,943. Declines led advances by a margin of nearly 5-1 in heavy trading of 236 million shares. This is NPR News. Salvadoran army forces ignored a rebel promise of a unilateral truce today and deployed troops in a zone that's traditionally been under rebel domination. The chief armed forces spokesman said the rebel ceasefire might be nothing more than a tactical maneuver to allow them to attack again later. Diplomats in San Salvador said that the army deployment could scuttle the rebels' initiative designed to end the fighting during the final phases of the peace negotiations in Mexico. In Northern Ireland, 3 men, 2 Catholics and 1 Protestant, were shot and killed last night, bringing to 9 the number of people killed in sectarian violence in the past week. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Even for Northern Ireland, this has been a bloody week, one of the bloodiest since the sectarian and political violence began in earnest in 1969. On Wednesday, the IRA killed 4 men and seriously injured a 5-week-old baby. The IRA said the men belonged to Protestant paramilitary groups. Last night, in what police say was a retaliatory attack by Protestants, two Catholics and one Protestant were killed as they drove home from work near Belfast. Police say the third man was simply mistaken for a Catholic. And in East Belfast, a bomb exploded early today in a department store, causing minor damage. Five other bombs were discovered and defused. The British government is planning to send additional troops to Belfast and to recruit more police in an effort to control the latest wave of violence. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
A federal appeals court has thrown out the Iran-Contra convictions of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. Poindexter was the highest-ranking Reagan administration official charged in the scheme to sell arms to Iran and use the profits to finance rebels in Nicaragua. He was convicted of five felony counts having to do with covering up the affair. Poindexter's convictions were thrown out on the grounds that they were based on immunized testimony that he gave before Congress. Charges against Poindexter's aide, Oliver North, were dismissed earlier after a similar ruling. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It looks like the second stage of the Middle East peace talks will begin after Thanksgiving. Now that Palestinians are meeting with Israeli officials, we wanted to get a sense of what's happening within the Palestinian leadership. My guest is Edward Said. He's a professor of English at Columbia University, and he was a member of the Palestine National Council from 1977 until the fall of this year when he resigned for health reasons. The PNC is the Palestinian Parliament in Exile. Said was born in Jerusalem when it was part of Palestine. Today we found out that one of the new faces in the Palestinian leadership might be arrested. Israeli police are recommending that the government arrest and prosecute Hanan Ashrawi for meeting with PLO officials in violation of an Israeli law which prohibits contact with terrorist groups. Ashrawi was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation and served as its spokesperson. I asked Edward Said his reaction to the news that Ashrawi might be arrested.
Well, I just think it's an act of provocation. I mean, there's no reason for suddenly wheeling it in, except that Hanan Ashrawi became very prominent in the last few months, and especially at Madrid, as the kind of symbolic and actual spokesperson for Palestinian nationalism. And second, and perhaps even more important, she has been the person, along with Faisal Husseini, who's been meeting with the Secretary of State in a series of meetings. It's no secret that she and Husseini, but perhaps especially she, has established a special relationship with James Baker. And so the idea is to strike her down, to put her out of commission, and to do so in a way that insults the United States and makes the Palestinians feel angry and vulnerable and despairing of moving forward towards peace. So on all kinds of grounds, in my opinion, it's a stupid and reckless and provocative thing to do. I myself don't think that they will do it. I think they will at the end pull back because I don't think they dare do that. Besides, both the Soviet Union and the United States have committed themselves now to their protection, to the protection of the Palestinian delegation that went to Madrid from the occupied territories.
What impact do you think it would have on the peace talks if Hanan Ashrawi is arrested?
Oh, I think it would stop them. I think there's no question that it would stop them for a while. I think there would be pressure placed on Israel by the entire international community because she is now an international figure. At Madrid there were well over 5,000 journalists there, and she was the nonstop person on the spot speaking about the Palestinian side of the negotiations. So I don't think in solidarity any of her comrades from the West Bank and Gaza would come forward, sheepishly to proceed to talk with the Israelis. And if they did, it would be only to talk about her release. But I think it ought to be mentioned here that putting her in jail or stopping her from traveling, which is a likely course also, it simply dramatizes further the processes against Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza. They have no civil rights at all.
Edward Said, you are a member of the Palestine National Council. You know, a lot of people are saying that the PLO is really calling the shots in the way on the Palestinian delegation to the peace talks and that a lot of the statements are cleared by the PLO beforehand. What would you say is the role of the PLO behind the scenes in terms of the Palestinian delegation to the talks?
You see, I think there's a fundamental misconception here. Everybody thinks of the PLO essentially as a group of people sitting in a room and sort of manipulating everything like puppet masters. You have to understand that the PLO is two things. It is, number one, a national authority. It is a kind of symbolic expression of the Palestinian of Palestinian political and national life, given, B, that we are all in exile or under military occupation. I mean, there is no Palestinian sovereignty over anything. So it can only function as the expression collectively of the will of a people. It has institutions in which hundreds of thousands of Palestinians participate, you know, having to do with health and social services and unions of one sort or another and industry and so on. But it's all done in a way that because we don't have territory and we are in exile, has to be, you know, sort of improvised. And it can't be done in a dictatorial way or in a conspiratorial way. It is done by people collaborating with each other, cooperating with each other across boundaries and in ways that are really quite ingenious and inventive. Now, among the people who are represented by the people, by the PLO, are the people on the West Bank and Gaza, who, you know, to a huge degree support the PLO. So, and all of us are connected to other Palestinians, whether on the West Bank and Gaza, inside Israel, in Lebanon, and places where Palestinians live, by bonds, not only of national bonds, but, you know, by relationships that are sometimes family, that have to do with associations. For example, Hanan Ashrawi and I are connected not only by the fact that we are Christians, but that we come from essentially the same community, the Protestant community. And I was her dissertation supervisor when she did her doctoral degree in the United States. So these associations, you know, multiplied hundreds, thousands of times, constitute the PLO. So in that respect, you could call it a gigantic fraternal or sisterly organization, if you like, in which Palestinians cooperate.
One of the aspects of the peace conference that has been most commented on by the Western press is the new leadership that emerged at the peace conference and how most of the Palestinian delegates to the conference were intellectuals, many of them university professors, many of them holding PhDs, and it just put a different face on the Palestinian movement for an independent state. Instead of seeing Yasser Arafat, who a lot of people see as a terrorist, you have these obvious intellectuals representing the Palestinian movement. Do you think that this is going to help the Palestinian movement, this new face of Palestinian leadership?
Well, you know, I think most Palestinians think that it's really there's a continuity there rather than a sudden change of personnel. In other words, I think for the first time it is true to say that Palestinians were treated as equals in a discussion about the Middle East on an international level. In other words, although the Palestinian delegation was part of the Jordanian delegation, their status was equal in that they spoke as much as the others. They, you know, spoke for 45 minutes at the opening ceremonies, and they are obviously partners, separate partners, in bilateral discussions with the Israelis. But I think, you know, I think there's been a tremendous exaggeration of the novelty and the new face and all that sort of stuff, and the new pragmatic line, you know, that has been urged by some, especially American journalists, I'd say, you know, like the people in the New York Times and all this sort of thing. The fact is that, you know, aside from Arafat and one or two others in the PLO, who had in the past represented the Palestinian viewpoint, they're the same people. You know, they're just different faces, but the language is the same. If you look at the PNC declarations of 88 and again of 1991, you'll notice that the language used in there was very similar to the language used in the speeches at Madrid and the statements made by Palestinians, and that a huge number of, you know, I'm a professor, you know, there are lots of professors and professionals and doctors and lawyers and so on, so it's essentially the same community, which for the first time has been given an opportunity, you know, to speak its own word, so to speak, and not to be treated in an adversarial and hostile manner, because I think a lot of it has to do with Israeli propaganda against the Palestinians, where they've painted Palestinians as a whole people. Now, we're not just talking about the Arafat, we're just talking about anything that Palestinians did from the Israeli point of view was terrorist. And what Palestinians have always been doing is resisting occupation and dispossession.
Some of the Palestinians who were in Madrid have already been talking to Israelis for years, not the government representatives, but doves in the Israeli movement.
Right.
And I'm thinking here of Hanan Ashrawi, Sari Nusebe.
Well, he wasn't in Madrid, actually.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Faisal Husseini, certainly, yes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Saeb Erekat probably has also had a lot of contact with the Israeli peace movement.
Right.
Now, a lot of people are interpreting the Madrid talks as having been... having achieved a lot in breaking the psychological barrier, because it's the first time that Palestinians and Israelis have really sat down at the table together. Given that a lot of the Palestinians who are there have already been sitting down with Israelis, but not official government Israelis, how much of a psychological barrier do you think was broken? How significant is it?
Oh, I think that's very significant. I mean, I think you're right to say that most of the Palestinians there were people who had participated for years in dialogues with Israeli doves, members of the peace movement, American Jews who were interested in this process, in this alternative process than the one of conflict and hostility and killing. That is certainly true. But I think you ought to remember, by the way, that part of the price exacted from the United States by Israel for attending the conference was that people like Hanan Ashrawi and Faisal Husseini, who have in fact pioneered this process of dialogue and peaceful exchange, were prevented from being members of the delegation. They were consigned to the delegation of advisors and were not allowed to enter the peace palace. So that what you saw of Husseini and Ashrawi and others was, you know, from another place, forbidden to enter the place in the peace palace in Madrid, because they are residents of Jerusalem, which Israel considers to be its own, and therefore, you know, they can't be there as members of the Palestinian delegation. So I think that point has to be made. But I think it also, the breakthrough is that there were members, in fact, the entire delegation, not that I can be absolutely certain about this, but I think the entire Israeli delegation was a delegation of hardliners, I mean, greater Israel ideologists, like Netanyahu and Rubinstein and the others, and of course above all Shamir, who represent a point of view that is totally opposed to any sort of Palestinian self-determination and statehood, who were, I think, in the end, obligated to sit there and listen to Palestinians of that stature and eloquence, telling them directly what, and as representatives of the government of Israel, what the Palestinian view on things in general was. And that's what the breakthrough was.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Said. He's a member of the Palestine National Council. He's a professor at Columbia University, the author of several books on various topics, including the Middle East and classical music. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. For just joining us, my guest is Edward Said, member of the Palestine National Council and a professor at Columbia University. What did you see as a hopeful outcome of the first part of the peace talks?
Well, I think, you know, that the Israelis didn't walk out, I thought was very significant. That in fact, nobody walked out. That there was a lot of challenge, there was a lot of give and take, positive and negative, and that people are staying on. I think curiosity, in a way. You know, this is a novel thing, and it's got to be said about Baker and Bush that they achieved something in bringing people there, and just the sort of the drama, the staging of enemies talking to each other, although a lot of the time at each other, is an extraordinary step. There's no doubt about that at all. And it was done in the full light of day. And it wasn't, I mean, there have been many meetings between Israelis and Arabs of various kinds, you know, secret meetings in disguise. And, you know, the Jordanians and the Syrians and the Israelis have met for years in secret. Peres has met with many Arab leaders and so on and so forth. But this was an open thing. And I think it established the precedent that nobody can now hide behind ideological formulas, let's say, whether Arab or Israeli, as an excuse for not meeting. Now, so that's the positive side, and I think it's very important. But we paid, as Palestinians, we paid a very heavy price. I mean, there were all these rules that we couldn't bring this kind of person, and this person had to be, et cetera, you know. And Baker negotiated that very skillfully, and I think, to be, you know, to be a little self-congratulatory here as a Palestinian, I thought we got through those hurdles, all of them placed by Israel, quite brilliantly. I mean, with the idea of an advisory delegation and another delegation of people and so on and so forth, so that there was a lot of Palestinian presence there, which I think, you know, dominated the scenes. And for the first time, Palestinians who are not the underdogs and the weakest party there, obviously, really came out quite brilliantly. But it does raise the question as to what happens next, rather severely, because nothing is very clear.
It sounds now that the Palestinian people are pretty divided. I mean, within the Palestinian movement, you have radical Islamic factions, radical political factions, and those radical groups opposed Palestinian participation in the peace talks.
Yeah, but I don't think they represent, you know, a tremendously large group of people. I mean, I think most of the figures that I've seen, and having spoken to some of the people who have to deal with this problem on the West Bank and Gaza, and others, in independent observers, I'd say that organizations like Hamas, for example, and all of the Islamic groups, I mean, there are two, three, really, at best represent something like 10 to 15% of the population.
I think I have to put you on the spot here. I believe that one of the incidents in question about whether Hanan Ashrari met with the PLO or not had to do with whether or not she attended meetings of the Palestine National Council recently. You attended some of those meetings. Would you comment on that? Was she there?
Well, I think I'd better let her answer that myself. I mean, I've known, as I told you, I've known Hanan for a long time, and she's a good friend and, as I say, a former student, and I've met her consistently over the years, so there's no reason for me not to have met her.
At the council meeting?
Well, whatever. I mean, whatever the site. I mean, I meet her. She comes to my house, and she's a friend and a former student, so I've met her in all sorts of... Now, as I say, I was not at the council meeting in question in Algiers in late September, but I certainly met her in the court, and I'm not a member of the PLO, so it's not an issue for me, but I mean, certainly she is a very widely known and respected and loved figure, and she's met lots of Palestinians.
How come you're not a member of the PLO?
Well, see, the PLO is not a membership organization. I mean, the members of the PLO are the people who work for the PLO, who are employees of the PLO, and I've never been an employee of the PLO. I believe, as all Palestinians do, that the PLO represents me. But in the strict sense of the word, I'm not a, sort of a card-carrying member.
Well, Edward Said, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Edward Said is a former member of the Palestine National Council and professor of English at Columbia University. Said says he thinks that if the Israeli government arrests Hanan Ashrawi, it would be an act of provocation that could derail the peace talks. We called Mark Sofer, Deputy Consul General of Israel in New York, and asked him first to explain the law which Ashrawi would be accused of violating.
As you know, the PLO, as a terrorist organization, one dedicated to the destruction of Israel, is an organization which has been outlawed by the Israeli parliament and the Israeli judicial system. As such, any contacts with such an organization are indeed illegal and apply to whoever they may do so.
What is the evidence against Hanan Ashrawi?
Well, as far as we understand, and I didn't actually see the interview myself, but I have the reports in, she appeared on Jordanian television mentioned and said there that she had, in fact, been in contact with the PLO. This, of course, is against the law in Israel, as she well knows, and therefore would have to go through the judicial processes, as would anybody.
The law that forbids contact with the PLO, is that phone conversations, or what kind of contact exactly is forbidden?
It actually applies to any contact with the PLO, and you may well know that it actually, it doesn't, this law, as any other, is not a selective law, in the sense that it doesn't apply only to those people who are unknown against those who are rather well-known internationally or locally. Indeed, There have been Israelis who have been tried or brought through the judicial processes for having such contacts with the PLO.
Now, some skeptics are saying that this is an intentional move on the part of Israel to derail the next stage of the peace talks. What comment would you have on that?
No, under no circumstances will it do so. The peace process in the Middle East is not based on any single personality on any side. It's a process which will encompass all parties and all people connected to it. As far as I understand, and as we all know, Hanan Ashrawi is not even a member of the Palestinian-Jordanian delegation to the talks. No, the peace process will move forward, and it'll move forward even if certain members of a Palestinian community do break the law. Hopefully they will desist from doing so in the future. Israel, for its part, will do its utmost to get the peace process moving forward as quickly and as ably as possible.
There is the possibility that the Palestinian delegation would pull out in protest if Ashrawi were arrested.
They would be doing that at their own disadvantage to do so, because in the final analysis, peace will have to be worked out between us and them. It would do no good for them to pull out on one issue or other issue or any other issue. And the only thing really to do is to move forward with us on the peace issue, forgetting or putting aside those issues which are connected to side subjects, such as an individual breaking the law and for which he or she must go through the judicial processes in Israel as accepted.
What about the possibility of some kind of diplomatic immunity for Hanan Ashrawi, since she is functioning in a kind of diplomatic process now?
Diplomatic immunity is granted to representatives of states, and there will be no state of Palestine. As such, she does not, should not be, and is not granted any type of diplomatic immunity or any type of diplomatic recognition, and that's accepted, of course, on all sides.
In describing the PLO, you described the PLO as being dedicated to the destruction of Israel. The official position of the PLO is to recognize Israel and to work toward a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I would be the last person to discuss and to decide what the official position of the PLO is. I believe you have one position today taken by one person within it and another one tomorrow taken by another. The position of the PLO is very clear. It's spelled out in its manifesto and its charter. That manifesto and charter call for the destruction of the State of Israel. The acts of terrorism and murder of Israelis, both Jews and non-Jews, including, incidentally, Palestinian dissenters, and Jews outside have proved that it has one aim and one aim alone, and that is the destruction of the State of Israel. Anything else is but a ploy to achieve that end.
Mark Sofer is the Deputy Consul General of Israel in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Food writer John Mariani spends a lot of time in restaurants. His new book, America Eats Out, is a history of restaurants going back to colonial days. Coming up, a talk with Mariani about hotel food, restaurant gimmickry, and the etiquette of eating out with kids. Michael Jackson's highly publicized music video, Black or White, premiered last night on TV. TV critic David Bianculli has the review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Martin Scorsese's remake of Cape Fear. Robert De Niro stars in the role originally played by Robert Mitchum. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The stock market closed out the week with its largest point drop in 2 years. The Dow Jones Industrial slid over 120 points as analysts said traders showed their concern over a series of negative economic reports this week. There was also apparent concern over a move on Capitol Hill to cap credit card interest rates and concern about what effect this might have on the nation's banks. In Washington, Iran-Contra case independent counsel Lawrence Walsh suffered another major setback today when a federal appeals court in Washington threw out 5 felony convictions against former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. The court's ruling is similar to one last year, reversing 3 felony convictions against Oliver North. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The appeals court ruled that the special prosecutor had not met his burden of proving that the trial testimony in the Poindexter case was unaffected by Poindexter's testimony before Congress in the summer of 1987. Writing for the majority, Judge Douglas Ginsburg said it would be pointless to send the Poindexter case back to the trial court, as is usually done, because the judge said the record has already demonstrated that the special prosecutor cannot rescue these convictions. But Judge Abner Mikva, in dissent, protested that the court had erected new and higher standards for the prosecutor to meet first in the North case, and that now the court was refusing even to let the prosecutor try to meet those standards. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In Yugoslavia, leaders of the federal and Croatian armies have agreed to order a ceasefire in Croatia. It begins at noon tomorrow Eastern Time. Talks are also to resume tomorrow on how to arrange a complete pullout in a month's time of the federal army from Croatian territory. Pierre Vickery has more.
The ceasefire agreement followed a marathon 10-hour meeting in Zagreb between the deputy commander of the Yugoslav armed forces in Croatia, General Rašeta, and the Croatian army commander, General Tus. The two military leaders agreed to order an absolute and unconditional ceasefire throughout Croatia to come into effect on Saturday. The Croatian army is to lift its siege of federal garrisons and facilities in the Republic, and the Yugoslav Navy will withdraw warships blocking access to Croatian ports. Talks are to resume on how to separate forces along the battle lines and the mechanism for the complete withdrawal from Croatia of Yugoslav army troops and facilities. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Once again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials plunged over 120 points to close at 2,943.20 on volume of some 236 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 5-1. This is NPR News. In Capitol Hill, Congress has approved a $5.3 billion jobless benefits bill and sent it to the White House. Approval came after a standoff in the Senate ended after 24 hours with agreement to make the benefits more generous in a second separate measure. By a vote of 91-2, the Senate gave final approval to the first part of the package, and the bill was sent to the White House where the president is expected to sign it. It appears that President Bush will try to coordinate an allied response to Libya in the wake of the indictment of 2 Libyan intelligence officials in Britain and the United States. The 2 were charged yesterday with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 in December of 1988. NPR's Neil Conan has more.
French President François Mitterrand said he expects a decision on Allied reprisals against Libya by Monday. Senior Libyan officials have also been charged on airplane bombing charges in France, and a British official said he expects Prime Minister John Major will be speaking with President Bush over the next few days. Official spokesmen have refused to rule out the use of force, but it appears that economic and diplomatic sanctions will be considered first. One problem is that Britain and the United States already have sanctions against Libya in place. Both London and Washington have rejected Libya's suggestion that the matter be referred to an international body like the World Court. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said today that a new investigation was an obvious attempt by the Libyans to stall and that the murder of U.S. citizens was properly a matter for U.S. courts. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
A White House spokesman today quoted the president as saying that it's fine with him if conservative columnist Pat Buchanan makes a run for the GOP presidential nomination next year. Yesterday, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater had said that there had already been one Buchanan, referring to 19th century president James Buchanan. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last night, on three separate networks, Michael Jackson received primetime exposure for his first music video of the 90s, an 11-minute extravaganza called Black or White. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of the video and some thoughts on Michael Jackson's place in music video history.
Put it this way, no recording artist has affected the look and status of rock videos as much as Michael Jackson. When Madonna brings out a new video, all she changes is her image. When Michael Jackson does it, sometimes he changes the entire industry. The first time it happened was in 1983 with Billie Jean, the first video from Jackson's Thriller album. She was more like Beauty Queen from a movie scene. I said, don't mind, but what do you mean? I am the one who could dance on the floor in the round. At the time, MTV was being widely and correctly accused of racism. Its video playlist was basically an all-white affair, and Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, Rick James, and Prince were all denied access. But Jackson's record company, CBS, reportedly threatened to withhold videos by all the label's artists, including MTV mainstays Billy Joel and Journey, unless MTV made room for Billie Jean. It did. That was Jackson landmark number one. Then came Beat It, which turned him into a superstar. The big deal with Beat It was the choreography. The song was about the stupidity of gang wars, and the video was patterned after West Side Story. The dancing was electric. And ever since then, dancers and dancing have been a big part of many, maybe even most, music videos. Jackson landmark number two. The Thriller video upped the stakes even higher. Once again, Jackson went to the movies for his video inspirations. This time, the movie was An American Werewolf in London, which Jackson enjoyed so much he hired the director, John Landis, and the special effects guy, Rick Baker, to turn him into a werewolf for Thriller. He and Landis set out to make the biggest, longest, most expensive video ever and made a big deal out of its release. They premiered the video on Showtime Cable, deliberately snubbing MTV, and took advance orders for a home video cassette called The Making of the Thriller Video. That cassette, like Jackson's Thriller album, topped the charts almost instantly. And creatively, the work on the Thriller video made some people look at videos as possible art, rather than total promotion. Jackson landmark number three. And now, skipping to 1991, comes Black or White. Black or white. This new video is as long as Thriller and features such guest stars as Macaulay Culkin, George Wendt, and Bart Simpson. Once again, Jackson's representatives have struck a hard bargain. MTV, in the midst of Michael Jackson Week, had to share last night's exclusive premiere with the Fox Network, which showed it at the exact same time, and the Black Entertainment Network, which presented it a half hour later. But with Black or White, the most impressive element isn't the business deal or the choreography. Once again, it's something Jackson took from the movies. The best parts of Black or White are the special effects. Jackson turning into a Black Panther, and a succession of singers of different sexes and races in close-up, with each face somehow seamlessly turning into the next. It's definitely oh-wow stuff. And it's the first music video use of the elaborate computer-generated special effects process from Terminator 2. That makes it Jackson landmark number 4. The second half of the video is more disjointed, and the symbolism there is up for grabs. When he dances without music and basically stages a one-man riot, smashing car windshields, throwing things through windows, it's not clear why he's doing it or what he's supposed to represent. One thing's for sure, though. Fox has the same high-profile deal for all other videos that'll be coming from the Dangerous album, and it's a good bet that one of them will be Jackson landmark number 5.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. This is Fresh Air. From the beginning, there was always a gimmick. That's how food writer John Mariani begins his new book on the history of American restaurants. He goes on to say that the American restaurant is never merely a place to eat. It's a place to go, to see, to experience, to hang out in, to seduce in, and to be seduced. Good taste has as much to do with it all as bad taste, and there's plenty of both to go around in this story. Mariani is the food and travel writer for Esquire magazine and the author of the Dictionary of American Food and Drink. His new book, America Eats Out, isn't just about restaurants, it's about entrepreneurs and their gimmicks. As America grew, new opportunities opened up for clever restaurateurs.
By the time you get into the Wild West days, one of the most interesting of all characters, I think, in American food service is an Englishman named Fred Harvey. And his gimmick was to improve food service on the railroads, because the railroads after the Civil War crisscrossed America, and the towns of in the West, in Utah and Kansas and Colorado, were established overnight as railroad depots, and you were lucky if you could get anything to eat, and there were certainly no restaurants. And what he did, Fred Harvey, was to open spanking clean, wonderful restaurants manned by good chefs with changing menus, and more important, he brought out tens of thousands of young women from the East who were called the Harvey Girls. And MGM made a movie about them, as a matter of fact, starring Angela Lansbury and Judy Garland. And he brought these women from the East into a Western landscape where the women in those days in food service would be pretty much bar girls and prostitutes in saloons and taverns. So that had a radical effect, and that was a great gimmick to have to be served by a waitress in a very white starched apron, which is all sent back to be laundered in Chicago, and to eat good food. And that was a great gimmick. So much of a gimmick that the Harvey restaurants never were expected to make any money for the railroad. But it was a gimmick to get people to travel on the railroad, which is where they made their money off the tickets.
Were you able to find anything out about why hotel food is so often bad or pretentious or too expensive, and why the hotels often have those like really big, large, hard, you know, cardboard kind of menus?
Yeah, the pretentiousness is due to the fact that they were, in the 19th century, almost invariably the best place in town. Which is to say that there weren't many restaurants in Boston and Chicago and St. Louis, and certainly not out west. So hotels functioned as the only place to eat, and they copied this Delmonico's model of great opulence, especially in the Gilded and Victorian age. What happened in the 20th century is that even though some of the best restaurants in America are still in hotels, they never changed their style very much. And to eat in a grand hotel meant red brocade wallpaper and tassels on the menu, and a whole lot of pretense, but the food itself went way downhill after World War II. They were using the frozen, and they were using the canned and the processed and the prepared foods. The unions made it very, very difficult for many hotel dining rooms to have great chefs and great cooks and good service. And because they were the only game in many towns and the only place you could eat, they took it for granted. A significant factor in the demise of hotel dining was the invention of the credit card, which was back in 1950-51 when Diners Club came out, which was just another gimmick that some guy thought up, who actually ran out of cash one day in a restaurant, and he thought of this Diners Club gimmick, and by the end of the year, he had a couple of hundred people, and the restaurants loved it because what it meant was that a businessman traveling to another city did not have to eat in his restaurant in the hotel where he could sign for it, and he didn't have to carry around a lot of cash. He could go to other restaurants around the city and just use his credit card. So that had that led to the demise of hotel dining rooms very rapidly.
You make the point that hamburgers, the American favorite, are now getting stiff competition from pizza. In my neighborhood, pizza was always a popular and favorite dish. But, you know, one thing I've noticed is that in more and more places, the pizza places, you know, the Italian family-run pizza place is getting replaced by the fast food chain pizza restaurant.
Yeah, this is a really awful development because the more Americanized that the pizza has become, and it is a Neapolitan invention, but was not known throughout Italy at all until well after World War II, the more pizzerias here. But, you know, Pizza Hut, which came out of Wichita, Kansas in the 1950s, I believe, or 60s, Pizza Hut was as far from an Italian pizza as possible to get. And yet Americans, especially in the Midwest, where it came from, love that sweet taste of the tomato sauce, love these disparate ingredients put on a not very good crust, and love the Pizza Hut taste. And that has kind of taken over the pizza industry, plus the fact that Domino's just really moved in big by promising they could get that pizza to you in under 30 minutes. But to find a good pizza of the kind you described, the family restaurant pizzeria, or some of the new kind of trendy pizzerias that do try to reproduce Italian pizzas, is not that easy to find anymore.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Mariani, and he's the food and travel correspondent for Esquire magazine and the author of the new book, America Eats Out, which is a history of American restaurants, taverns, coffee shops, and so forth. What kind of restaurants did you go to when you were growing up?
Well, at least once a week, I grew up in the Bronx, and at least once a week, we would go to this, at the time, combination pizzeria and Italian restaurant. We would go into the city, into Manhattan, that is, which we call the city, even though I live in the Bronx, and we would go to places like Schraff's for lunch. And my parents loved to eat out. My father really did, and his wife, my mother, was a very, very good cook. So we would go to places that were kind of special. We never went for Chinese food. We never, very, very rarely went for French food, at least the children didn't. And I remember a place called Patricia Murphy's, which used to have several outlets up here in the Northeast, and where the great thing about it was you'd arrive with your family, and you'd give your name, and you'd wait to see if you were going to be put into the gold room, the silver room, the crystal room, or the peppermint room. And you'd wait with bated breath, and you'd hear, Mariani party to the gold room. And you'd say, hey, we got the gold room today, you know. And this is all a gimmick, too, as I said in the book, that this was part of the gimmick, and you'd sit down and had hot popovers were brought, and you had your own loaf of bread right there on the table. And these were all gimmicks. The food was not very good at Patricia Murphy's. But it brought carloads, if not busloads, of people in.
You have a couple of kids, right?
Two boys.
Where do you take them? Where'd you take them when they were even younger, if you wanted to eat out with the family?
Well, when my first son was born, we literally, when he was 3-4 months old, we just put him in a basket and cover him over, and most of the time he'd sleep, or you put him in a knapsack on your back. And we actually went to France and traveled to 2- and 3-star restaurants that way until one night he woke up. But now we take them out all the time, but we choose restaurants that are children-friendly. And I don't mean fast food. I mean good Italian restaurants, Chinese restaurants, restaurants owned by families where they understand, restaurants that are fairly casual. I mean, I'm not going to take them to Le Bec Fan. I'm not going to take them to Lutèce or places like that. They're simply not going to enjoy it. But I will certainly take him to a good steakhouse. And they enjoy the experience. I found with kids, if I can give one piece of advice to all of your listeners, when you take your children out, don't ask them what they want to eat, because invariably they'll say, you know what, pizza or hamburgers. What you should do is order a whole bunch of things and have it spread out on the table, and invariably, I guarantee you, they'll pick at this and that, the aromas will get to their nose, and they will end up eating things you couldn't imagine they would have ever eaten. And this is what we always do. We never let them order anymore. We just put, here's some veal, here's some scallops, here's some broccoli, here's some onion rings, and invariably they will eat three or four out of the things that are on the table.
And are you eating from the same plates?
Oh, yeah, sure.
When your kids were a little younger, what would you do if you took them to a restaurant and they started to act up?
Usually end off the meal as soon as is feasible. I mean, I would ask for the check and leave, because I don't think that anybody should put up with that, parents and other people in the restaurant included. So if we're on our appetizer and the kids were acting up or something, we would just pay the check and call it a night.
If you could go back in time, is there a particular restaurant you would have loved to have tried?
Oh, yeah. No question about it. There's a place which was called Le Pavillon. Very important restaurant, which most people probably have never heard of, except what happened was, back in 1939, World's Fair, the French Pavilion had this restaurant called Le Pavillon. It was their pavilion. And it had standards of service and silverware and glassware and napery and linen and spectacularly good French food. That was all the rage for at least the time that the 1939 World's Fair was open. And afterwards, the manager of that restaurant opened his own place in New York, which he called Le Pavillon. And it set standards which even today, if you go into the typical French restaurant in the United States or even continental restaurant, you will, by and large, 9 times out of 10, see 90% of the items that were on Le Pavillon's menu. And his name was Henri Soule. And I would have loved to have dined there, but unfortunately went out of business in 1971, at which time I was still eating in Indian restaurants and little ethnic places and brown rice and trying to get through the counterculture.
Okay. Well, John Mariani, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's great. It's been a great, great pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
John Mariani is the food and travel writer for Esquire magazine and the author of the new book, America Eats Out. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll have news of a U.S. appeals court throwing out the conviction of John Poindexter, former national security advisor of President Reagan's, who was a leading figure convicted in the Iran-Contra affair. His conviction now thrown out. Also, we'll be hearing from Stephen Emerson about the indictments in the Pan Am 103 case. He had written a book which found the Syrians and Iranians responsible for the Pan Am 103 bombing, together with a radical Palestinian faction. The government now denies that. We'll hear what he has to say about it. And also a report from John Burnett on the Louisiana governor's race between Edwin Edwards and David Duke.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic Stephen Schiff says the scariest film of 1962 was J. Lee Thompson's B-movie Cape Fear, starring Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck. Well, 29 years later, Cape Fear is back, only this time it cost $35 million, and its credits are A-list all the way, with Robert De Niro, Nick Nolte, and Jessica Lange starring, and Martin Scorsese directing. But does the new Cape Fear beat the old one? Stephen has some answers.
Well, you could say the new Cape Fear beats the old one. The problem is it beats it to a bloody pulp. I've long thought that Martin Scorsese was the best American director currently working. And nothing about the new Cape Fear disproves that. No one else could have made this movie. No one else could have put on such a virtuosic display of cinematic trickery, movie references, eye-popping compositions, and edge-of-your-seat thrills. Scorsese has made a suspense chiller with the creamy, widescreen look of 50s Hitchcock. And he's even had Elmer Bernstein reorchestrate the garish score Bernard Herrmann wrote for the original Cape Fear. The scholarship is impeccable, and the technique state-of-the-art. But Scorsese's Cape Fear is also the meanest movie in recent memory, a display of brutal directorial flexing that may leave you more resentful of his skill than grateful for it. Scorsese and his screenwriter, Wesley Strick, have stayed faithful to the original storyline, and the touches they've added are all very shrewd. Once again, a monster just released from prison is out for revenge. Only this time, the monster is over-the-top Robert De Niro instead of the eerily affectless Robert Mitchum. And the lawyer he wants to wreak havoc on is his former defense attorney, played by edgy Nick Nolte, not noble Gregory Peck. De Niro believes Nolte betrayed him and mishandled his defense. And now he wants to pay him back. And not just him, but his wife, played by Jessica Lange, and his 15-year-old daughter, played by Juliette Lewis. The filmmakers have taken what was once a straightforward battle between good and evil and added layers of moral ambiguity and sexual uncertainty. Nolte himself is far from a virtuous man in the movie, and his family is about to explode even without De Niro to light the fuse. In the film's best scene, Scorsese holds the camera still long enough to capture the erotic tension De Niro has been able to pour into the family's cracks and fissures. De Niro poses as a drama teacher in order to get the daughter alone in the dark fantasy world of the deserted school theater. And there he toys with her in ways that freeze the blood.
We all make mistakes, Danielle. You and I have, but at least we try to admit it, don't we?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause your dad is not happy. Your mommy's not happy. And you know what? You're not happy. Are you?
No, I'm not.
You thought about me last night, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Do you mind if I put my arm around you?
That scene stands out in this frantic movie because it's the one place where the mounting terror is sustained simply by terrific actors playing characters we're interested in. The rest of the time, the movie wants to punch your lights out. The cutting is fast, but not TV commercial fast. It's too fast, arrhythmic, off-kilter. The compositions are purposely unsettling even when there's nothing to unsettle us about what's going on. There are lots of meaninglessly emphatic close-ups and zooms. And the acting is often weirdly, inappropriately jumpy. You sit in your seat feeling tense, short of breath, unpleasant. It's as if you had the symptoms of suspense without really experiencing suspense. This movie's effects are powerful but unearned, and after a while you want to fend them off like a disease. I have nothing against scary movies. In fact, the best American film I've seen this year was The Silence of the Lambs. But Cape Fear isn't genuinely scary, it's merely assaultive. And there's something terribly cynical about it. It's as if Scorsese didn't trust or care about his characters enough to let them touch us on their own. Instead, he shoves them in our faces. A lot of people are going to feel like simply stepping out of the way.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Volker Schlondorf is one of Germany's best-known filmmakers. His movies include The Tin Drum and the TV production of Death of a Salesman, which starred Dustin Hoffman. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about Schlondorf's new film and how his life has changed since the reunification of Germany. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.